Greetings, and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR, and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. Perspectives in Religious Studies is a journal published by the National Association of Baptist Professors of Religion. This past fall, the journal featured articles examining how Southern evangelicals engage the culture of the New South. Edited by Joe Coker of Baylor, the issue contains articles by John Hayes, Paul Harvey, Fred Arthur Bailey, Kelly Baker, Glenn Feldman, and myself. For today's podcast, we will talk to two of these authors, John Hayes and Glenn Feldman. But first, we turn to Professor Coker, who teaches in the Department of Religion at Baylor. He is also author of Liquor in the Land of the Lost Cause, Southern White Evangelicals and the Prohibition Movement, 1880 to 1915. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to this issue, I want to ask about your book, Liquor in the Land of the Lost Cause, because I see this as a story of Southern evangelicals being shaped by the culture of the New South and shaping the culture of the New South. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
One of the things that drove the book was this understanding of this kind of symbiotic relationship between Southern white evangelicals and the larger culture around them, that they shaped that larger culture, but in a lot of ways were deeply shaped by it. And so by focusing on the issue of the push for prohibition in the late 1800s, early 1900s, I found that a great window into this relationship between the church and the culture in the South. One of the things that comes out in the study in the book is in the effort to eradicate alcohol from society, these Southern white evangelicals played on a lot of Southern cultural attitudes about politics and race and women and the concept of honor in order to communicate their message as well as in order to sway the larger public. So in a lot of ways, they end up embracing a lot of racist ideas, for instance, and using them to fuel the argument for prohibition.
You know, that's interesting, and I'm wondering if you could pick up on something there, because when I think about culture and liquor, one of the things you highlighted in your book was the labels and the way in which evangelicals preyed upon the labels to advance their cause. I wonder if you could just share that with us.
Right. That's a fascinating aspect of the marketing, I guess, of alcohol in the late 1800s and especially the first couple of decades of the 20th century, that cheap liquor was oftentimes marketed directly towards an African-American consumer. And oftentimes included labels on the bottle or slogans on the bottle or posters in these bars that were laden with sexual innuendos and suggestions that the liquor might contain some sort of aphrodisiac. And this really provided for a lot of Southern white evangelicals the smoking gun that linked alcohol and bad behavior on the part of African Americans and allegations of black men raping white women. And this these bottles really just kind of brought the two together and proved a link between those.
So you have this background coming into this. Tell us about how this issue of Perspectives in Religious Studies came into being.
Well, the editor of Perspectives in Religious Studies, Mike Parsons, is a colleague of mine and suggested that I guest edit an issue looking at some aspect of Southern religion. And so my mind immediately went to this era of the New South, a period that was particularly tumultuous in the South, lots of changes going on, the end of the old planter aristocracy being replaced by a rising capitalistic entrepreneur class, and the aftermath of Reconstruction and being replaced with white rule and increasing disfranchisement and segregation. And so I've always been fascinated with the role of the church played in this whole process, how the church affected that process, and as we were saying, how the church was in turn affected by the changes that were going on in society. So I wanted to have the issue focus on how evangelicals in this New South era shaped this new culture in their own image and likewise how it changed them as well. And was very fortunate to get a wonderful collection of authors together, all of whom contributed very nice pieces, giving us some insight into this time period.
What themes emerged to you when you saw these different articles come together in one package?
I think it provides a better understanding of this concept, going back to Wilbur Cash's saying that the South constituted almost a nation within a nation. the distinctiveness of Southern culture in general, Southern white evangelical Christianity in particular. And one of the things that comes through in so many of these articles is that in this tumultuous era when Southern whites had an opportunity to shape Southern culture in constructive ways, it failed largely to adequately address some of the key issues and concerns of the era, and instead allowed themselves in many ways to be shaped by the larger culture and to kind of tap into entrenched racial attitudes, for instance, as well as the new economic forces that were sweeping through the South at the time. So I think it's an instructive and sometimes disheartening story about missed opportunity on the part of the church in the South.
And I think this is interesting because I saw some comparisons coming through here. We have Paul Harvey talking about progressives and race, and then we move over to Kelly Baker, who's talking about the Klan, and then Fred Arthur Bailey's dealing with schools. When you put those three together, race really comes through as being this dominant theme, and it's all over the place. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, it's certainly such a pervasive feature of Southern culture at this time and Southern Christianity, and the way in which Southern evangelicals found themselves embracing the racial attitudes and stereotypes of the larger culture certainly comes through. And it came out when I was doing my study on Prohibition. I think it's hard to look at any aspect of Southern culture and not find it laden with these kinds of racial attitudes. Even Paul Harvey's piece, where he's looking at the more progressive thinkers of the period, finds that they nevertheless kind of succumb to these patterns of paternalism and equating social progress with racial control. It's kind of inescapable and hard to find a strong way in which the church responds positively to the challenges of this era.
What do you want readers to take away from this?
Well, I think one thing to take away is just a greater consciousness of the way in which church and larger society and larger culture work together and shape one another, the way in which the church doesn't operate in a vacuum, that it is in many ways a product of its environment. And also, I think we see, I think it's helpful for us to better understand the events since the early 20th century, the civil rights movement, as well as more recent phenomenon, and appreciated Glenn Feldman's piece, which kind of brought us to the present and looked at the way in which a distinctively Southern brand of evangelical Christianity continues to shape American politics and American Christianity.
Okay, Joe, well, thank you very much. We're going to move on to the authors now, but thanks for setting up our conversation.
Thank you very much, Art. Appreciate it.
Now I'd like to introduce John Hayes to the podcast. He teaches history at Georgia Regents University and is currently working on a book about folk Christianity in the South. His article for this edition was entitled "The Evangelical Ethos and the Spirit of Capitalism." John, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Yeah, thanks, Art.
Well, I want to start with the title because that's a great title and it evokes German sociologist Max Weber. And so I want you to just sort of make the connection between Weber and Southern evangelicals and labor.
The title is definitely intended to tip off the reader to the Weber connections, which, as the article opens and as others before me have uncovered, Weber visited North Carolina in the early 20th century, has an anecdote that is based on his baptism in North Carolina near Mount Airy. So basically, titling the essay that, beginning with Weber, was a way to highlight the question of the specific kind of evangelical culture or cultures that developed after the Civil War and the new economy of the New South, and see if there wasn't some connection there that maybe had not been analyzed or made as explicit as I thought it could be.
So what was the relationship between evangelicals and New South capitalism?
I mean, at least the argument I make, and this is just sort of a thumbnail sketch in the little essay, but you know, drawing on a pretty wide body of scholarship from the past 25 years or so, is that the specific, or what became the dominant themes for both white and black evangelicals in the New South era, these themes of respectability and domesticity, which if you just go to books on, you know, religious histories of black and white evangelicals in this period, these are the dominant overriding themes. My question was, were these at all connected to the essentially sort of small-scale market capitalism of the New South? And my answer was, yes, very much so, that respectability essentially idealized a code of behavior that not coincidentally made for basically capitalist activity. You know, the most obvious thing and best known for a long, long time is the evangelical campaign against the use of alcohol. And certainly there's fairly obvious economic logic in that. It has to do with sort of self-discipline, self-control, seeing time as a resource, money is something that should be saved and invested. And then with domesticity, I think, you know, at least I'm sort of toss out provisioning this argument that domesticity was a way to offer a kind of a refuge from the world of the market. So as markets spread into most corners of the New South by the early 20th century, there's a lot of cutthroat competition, the amorality of the ebb and flow of market. And so to play up the home, which of course evangelicals in either the northern United States or across the Atlantic had already been doing, the play of the home was a way to offer a kind of haven and refuge from the cold, hard world of the market.
You know, for me, it's easy to link this discourse of respectability to white evangelicals, but you make a note that it is coming into black culture too. Can you talk about the uniquenesses of respectability within black circles?
If you look at a couple like classic works, newer works on basically black evangelical culture in the New South period, say Evelyn Higginbotham or John Giggie, at least what is being, you know, the behaviors that are being idealized in the religious culture, the dominant messages, I would say paradoxically, are just not that different from what one is hearing in, among white evangelicals. It's very similar themes of respectability and domesticity. So at least on paper, the message is, I would say, remarkably dovetails, even in an era, of course, of segregation and white supremacy. The key sort of difference there has been the social position of black Southerners gives both respectability and domesticity, but especially respectability, gives it a much more subversive and critical meaning. So the insofar as black evangelicals modeled respectability, which Giggie plays up how clothing and sort of cleanliness and the well-kept home were kind of hallmarks of this black evangelical culture. Insofar as they modeled those things, they were essentially living refutations of what white supremacists were saying. Whether or not white supremacists acknowledged that, the best evidence or, you know, overwhelming evidence seems to be that they did not. But it does mean that the black evangelical culture takes on a much more tone of kind of critique and challenge to the dominant white racist culture.
Well, by the end of the article, we turn attention away to poverty in the New South, and you note that this is sort of the other half of the South. Mm-hmm. And you end quite provocatively saying, quote, that this is the subject of another story.
Right.
I'm assuming that you have something to say about this, and I'm wondering what briefly you could tell us.
Yeah, so there's definitely another story. So, some of the stuff was, this was essentially in the essay I was putting out for public consumption, intellectual groundwork I felt I had to do for my own project. The evangelical cultures that emerge in the New South era, meaning the sort of white and black evangelical cultures that are very well known, and many people in the 20th century look back and see it's kind of the old-time religion, et cetera, et cetera. Those very much have a class element and have meaning sort of, I would probably get so far to say they're a culture around which a certain class can coalesce. But if we emphasize that, then that immediately raises the question of how in the New South era, people who either remained stuck in poverty or actually fell into poverty from a kind of modest prosperity, how this message could at all have actually meaning and resonance to them. And basically, I would say that it did have meaning and resonance for them has much more often been asserted rather than proven. And I actually don't think that if you look closely, there's any proof, there's much proof there to speak of. And so basically what I see happening is in the same New South era, among the poor, who numerically we may be talking as much as half of the population, certainly at least a third of the population, a very different, to use the term loosely, very different evangelical culture takes shape, that to distance it from these better known evangelical cultures, I'm calling folk Christianity. And the messages there are very different. The themes are very different. To give sort of one example, in the well-known white and black evangelical culture, evil essentially gets, or evil, or so this power of the devil or Satan, essentially becomes idle, wasteful activities or behaviors that don't foster this sort of respectability or this sort of upstanding capitalist citizenship. And with the folk Christians, there's much more of a sense of evil in the world as this sort of irrational and in many ways intangible reality that you're kind of always there struggling with, but to reduce it to something like a red light district or a behavior that you can prohibit would be essentially unimaginable. It's a much more kind of power in the world that can't be just reduced to a certain set of behaviors or certain place in the society. So that's kind of one example. There's much more to say there. Obviously, at the end of the essay, I was trying to suggest that we know that in the New South era, there was poverty blanketed a lot of people in the region. If we keep that in mind and then talk about how evangelical cultures of the New South had very much a class message, one that has been called bourgeois, then the disconnect between this message and the lives of the poor becomes fairly apparent.
Well, it sounds like you do have plenty more story to tell.
Yes, I hope so.
Right. So we'll let you go. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Our final guest for today is Glenn Feldman, professor of history at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Professor Feldman's most recent book is Painting Dixie Red, When, Where, Why, and How the South Became Republican. His contribution to Perspectives is entitled Making the Southern Religion, Economics, Theology, Martial Patriotism, and Social Indifference, and The Big Bang Theory of Modern American Politics. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So why don't you start us off and tell us, what is the essence of the Southern religion?
Basically, the essence of the Southern religion is that it is not comprised solely of theology. That economics, a special understanding of economics, patriotism, and an attitude towards social responsibility are as important as theology in making up the distinctive Southern religion. And it is thus impossible to separate before, even for the convenience of academic disciplines, for the sake of academic researchers from particular disciplines. You can't talk about politics today in the South, and you haven't for a long time, without talking about religion and vice versa. The assumptions that are made in terms of politics come directly from religion. And in fact, political behavior can be described almost as religious behavior or a type of religious behavior. Integrated within that is our attitudes on economics and a kind of reflexive martial patriotism too, and that's what the article's about.
Do you suggest that there was something of a, quote, Big Bang after Reconstruction that led to this, what you call throughout the article, the Southern religion? Could you talk about that?
The basic idea I wanted to drive across was that there was a Southern religion, the Southern religion, and what I mean by that is the way I view it is that it's made up of four major components. One is economics, one is theology, obviously. One is a kind of unquestioning martial concept of patriotism and what patriotism is, and a fourth one is a social indifference that manifests itself not in private individual terms, but in terms of a rejection, really, of common or collectivist or federal or governmental efforts to alleviate social problems. And the Big Bang part of it came in because I think all this kind of coalesced in the South during Reconstruction, with the Reconstruction experience, although there were definite elements which led up to the formation of the what I call the Southern religion prior to Reconstruction. I mean, I think when we talk about economics in these terms, we're talking about a libertarianism, and even something that exceeds libertarianism, to view government or the proper role of government as a state prop of profit making. And obviously, this has roots elsewhere. In terms of theology, we're talking Calvinist theology, which manifests in the Baptist, Methodist, and some Presbyterian supermajority in the South, and so forth. Social Darwinism is in there in terms of social indifference. And then we have the unique Southern experience with war, defeat, occupation, and so forth. But I think it's important to go back a little further and look at the question of why did the distinct Southern religion evolve in the South, whereas a distinct Northern religion did not. And I think that question leads us to the historical development of the South as opposed to other regions. First of all, none of these are absolutes. I mean, I recognize that there are exceptions to each one of these concepts. But basic point is that in general, taken together, we can speak in these terms, even though there are notable exceptions that can be found throughout history to everything I'm saying. At some point, we have to, I think, take the evidence that's available and make a general conclusion that recognizes that there are exceptions. Sometimes these exceptions, many times these exceptions in the Southern experience actually prove the rule. In terms of early on, I think that obviously many of these elements came southward from the north. The Protestant work ethic, social Darwinism, the Calvinism of the Puritans and other groups up north. What's different about the South is that there was a much more homogenous population, a much more homogenous culture. There was rural agrarian isolation. There was very quickly a defense of slavery, lead up to the Civil War and then segregation and all kinds of things based on biblical and religious reasoning. There was more of a white Protestant Anglo population, and we can go on. There are many, many, many variations of why the South developed along different lines from the North, but in many of these respects, the South became so distinct, and I know that's a concept that's under assault currently in some circles of academic history, but it's a concept that I think is rather obvious in the Southern past. So the basic argument is that you take all these things together and put them in a section of the country that doesn't really have a lot of mitigating factors. For instance, in the North, certainly we have Calvinism, certainly we have Puritanism and so forth, but we also have the New England commitment to the common weal, the New England commitment to the common interest, to the great university, to education. We do not have the Southern experience with defeat in war, which in many ways eradicates the need to prove and reprove and prove again Southern patriotism through martial exploits, kind of unquestioning martial exploits, whether it's to the Southern homeland or from the Spanish-American War on all the way to every American conflict since. In terms of economics, there is a desperation in the South because the war is fought in the South. I mean, with the notable accessions of Gettysburg and Antietam, the Civil War is pretty much fought in the South, and we're talking about massive destruction of railroad, of industries, of manpower. Then there's the loss of slave labor, psychological effects of occupation, the rebuilding of the South and the New South movement. And so what we get is an unprecedented, really, in American history, situation in which the South has these elements, they're virtually undiluted versus the experience in other parts of the country, and they come together in the Reconstruction experience, and there really is kind of a big bang of producing a culture and a region and a continuity there that does view economics, religion, patriotism, and social responsibility in terms that are quite different than the rest of the American experience.
What do you see as the legacy of the Southern religion?
There are a couple of things. I mean, one, there are some tragic roads that are not taken. Obviously, you know, there's a union movement in the South. There's populists. There are other roads that are tried out and pretty much snuffed out eventually or come apart. They're broken apart on the anvil of race. But as far as a legacy today, what we have nationally in terms of whether it's the conservative wing of the Republican Party or increasingly what passes for the mainstream of the Republican Party or mainstream conservatism, these are all pretty much old Southern ideas and ideals that have been exported, really. This idea that the proper role of government is to prop up business. I mean, we have a dearth of real free market capitalism in this country, whether we're talking about bailing out Wall Street banks are bailing out automotive companies that are simply too big. It's very difficult to reconcile that type of government behavior with classical capitalist economics in which competition is supposed to be the rule and enterprises that are not efficient don't make money go out of business. Government doesn't come in and save them. But in the South, that's exactly what government did, and that was the purpose of government during the New South movement, was to attract business at any cost, to make sure business survived at any cost, to view the businessman as a hero, as a social benefactor, more than just someone who was making a profit. In terms of theology, you know, we see increasingly more and more extreme expressions of Old Testament ideas, whether we're talking about, you know, people actually speaking in public about possibly executing children that disobey their parents or disrespect them, or putting homosexuals to death, or engaging in war for this reason or that reason. This is really an old story, an old Southern story that's been taken nationally. And one incredibly important aspect of this is the issue of social responsibility. In the South, through its history, although there have been, again, some exception to that. The people here are genuinely very warm, very charitable, and so forth towards their neighbor. But, and a lot of this is religious-based. It's religious duty. The difference is that there's an antipathy to governmental activism or collective activism in terms of helping the poor, the unfortunate, the needy, and so forth. And that's basically anathema here. And we've seen that play out at the national level more and more in recent years. And it's frankly somewhat disturbing. There's a disconnect between helping the poor in your community here in the South and giving away free tax dollars to the unworthy 47% of freeloaders and moochers and takers and parasites and so forth that are associated with the philosophy of Ayn Rand or even some of the utterances of people like Mitt Romney during the 2012 election. So I think that the legacy for the present and future is that what we're seeing on a national level in some ways that's somewhat disturbing has long, deep roots in the Southern experience.
Well, that leaves us plenty to think about. Thank you very much to Glenn Feldman, as well as Joe Coker and John Hayes for joining us today. If you'd like to find out more about Perspectives in Religious Studies, we have a link to it at our website, jsr.fsu.edu. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.